This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. America's war on terrorism is being waged on a number of fronts, and if a new report from a panel commissioned by Congress is any indication, the United States may be losing the battle for the hearts and minds of Muslims living overseas. The panel, the Advisory Group on Public Diplomacy for the Arab and Muslim World, released their report yesterday, which says that in the Muslim world, hostility to America has reached shocking levels, and the bottom has fallen out of support for the United States. The 13-member panel appointed by the State Department says the U.S. needs to put more effort and resources into public diplomacy in order to influence public opinion overseas. Among other things, the panel recommends the creation of a cabinet-level special counselor and an advisory board to coordinate outreach efforts. But can public diplomacy work even when American foreign policy is coming under intense criticism in the Arab world? Have you been overseas and noticed how American foreign policy and American culture is perceived? Whether or not you like our current foreign policy, what efforts do you think would be effective to offset hostility toward the U.S.? We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and you can reach us at our email address, totn@npr.org. Later in the hour, the latest claims from North Korea about their nuclear capability and an apology from Arnold Schwarzenegger. But first, selling America overseas. With us now is a member of that advisory panel, James Glassman. When he's not consulting for the federal government, James Glassman is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. He's with me here in Studio 3A, and thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Len.
First of all, maybe you can give us a little précis of the findings, the most important findings in that report.
Actually, I'll read you the first sentence. The United States today lacks the capabilities in public diplomacy to meet the national security threat from political instability, economic deprivation, and extremism, especially in the Arab and Muslim world. What we're saying is that public diplomacy, which helped win the Cold War and can help win the war on terrorism, is not taken seriously here. Not anywhere near as seriously as, for example, military tools or state-to-state diplomacy. Public diplomacy is really the way we communicate with the rest of the world, and we do a very poor job of it, not because of the people who are doing it, but because they lack the resources and they lack the strategic direction, and that's what we want to be applied.
Tell me what goes into public diplomacy as opposed to just diplomacy. What's
sure.
the difference, and what are the components that we're talking
about? Well, diplomacy
about?
Is generally thought of as high-level officials talking together, and that's very, very important. There's no doubt about that. Public diplomacy is how we communicate diplomatically in the open through, well, probably the most famous tool of public diplomacy was Radio Free Europe during the Cold War, which beamed news and information behind the Iron Curtain. Now, things have changed, and whether we need that kind of institution today is another question. But it's exchange programs, such as the Fulbright program, which sends, which brings foreign students to the United States to really learn about the United States. It is also such elements as simply our messages through public affairs channels to media abroad. It is libraries that the United States operates abroad. It is translation services, magazines, and so forth.
What's the difference between public diplomacy and propaganda? Is it different?
I think it's really very much in the mind of the beholder. We do not advocate propaganda in the sense of twisting the truth or sugarcoating, and we say that very clearly. The truth is the United States has a very good story to tell. Now, it is also true that many people in the Arab and Muslim world don't like specific policies of ours, such as toward the Palestinian Israeli conflict and in Iraq. But in general, the broad outlines of American policy are shared by most people around the world. And American values, or universal values as practiced in America, democracy, tolerance, and we're not always perfect in these things, these are shared around the world. So there's no need for propaganda in the sense of lying or twisting the truth.
Now, before we get into your recommendations, I want to ask you a little bit about the process of gathering this information. As I understand it, members of the panel traveled in Muslim countries and Arab countries. I'm wondering if you yourself or stories from some of the other members of the panel, if anything was really really surprising to you. Did you uncover anything you didn't expect to find? Did you see anything that was particularly shocking or surprising to you?
Let me just talk briefly about what we did, because I think it's kind of unique to the American system. This was a panel that was appointed through an act of Congress. The administration appointed the chairman, Ed Derijian, a very distinguished former ambassador to Syria and Israel. There were 12 members on the panel in addition. None of us was paid. We all volunteered our time, which was an enormous amount of time. It was quite intensive over 3 months. We traveled to Syria, Egypt, Turkey, France, United Kingdom, Senegal, Morocco. We did video conferencing from Pakistan and from Indonesia. What did we see that was surprising to us? I would say I was kind of an unusual member of the panel because I am basically a kind of a generalist who mainly looks at economic issues, and I'm a former editor and former publisher, so I was sort of the communications person. There are a couple of communications people. Most people are academics who really know a lot about the region. Six of them spoke Arabic, one speaks Urdu, one speaks Farsi. So they were very well acquainted, much more than I was, I think, with the region. But I think we were all struck by the depth of feeling against, not just against American policies, but also, in many cases, against really American culture, but in most cases based on a lot of misconceptions. We were also, I would say, most struck by the fact that America is not present for the conversation, for the debate that's going on in these countries. Now, a lot of the debate, there's no doubt about it, is slanted, it's quite strident and anti-American. But it is a very, in my opinion, a very sincere debate and a very important debate. It's taking place on programs like this one in the Arab and Muslim world. But we're not present.
Why not? Why are we not there?
Well, it's a shame. Part of the problem is there aren't enough. It comes down to something as simple as this. Part of the problem is there aren't enough Arabic speakers. We were shocked to learn that there are only 54 speakers in the State Department that have what's called level 4 competency, which is basically fluency. And some of those really, their level 4 fluency is kind of lapsed. And of those, no more than 5 are ready and willing to participate on programs such as this, or programs on Al Jazeera, programs on Al Arabiya TV, satellite TV programs. So we're not in the debate. We are just not there. And that is a tremendous deficit. Imagine, for example, we heard a program when we were in Egypt on Al Arabiya, which is a satellite broadcaster, called the Americanization of Islam. You know, the idea being that America is kind of trying to take over this religion, which we're not doing, obviously. But there was not a single American voice on that program. Now, I can tell you that I'm almost certain that an American voice would have been welcomed on that program, but it wasn't being heard. So we're not participating. I think that's part of it. And the other part is that it's very hard for people in the Arab Muslim world to gain a context. It's hard for them to understand, for many of them. For example, they watch Friends on television. Mm-hmm. They watch Seinfeld. They watch Dallas. Americans watch these programs too and understand that this is entertainment. It tells us a little bit about American society, but it doesn't reflect what America is about. We can put it into context. Many people can't. Many people in the Arab and Muslim world, and they feel quite threatened by these things. So that's necessary too.
Now, I know one of the recommendations is that more resources are needed, and also the creation of a cabinet-level post. Tell me what that post would be and what that person would do, how it would help in this mission.
The objective is to achieve strategic direction. You need a long-term view, you need consistency of messages, and you need to coordinate what's going on across the government. Now, I don't want to get too bureaucratic, but strategic direction is important. And we recommend that strategic direction come from a cabinet-level special counselor in the White House. That's the best place for it. The president, as we say in our report, is really the director of public diplomacy.
So this wouldn't be a cabinet officer?
It would not be a cabinet officer. It would be not in the sense of someone who would be, you know, a secretary of state or a secretary of the treasury, but there are people within the White House who have cabinet rank. That is to say, that they go to cabinet meetings. What we're saying is we want you to take this seriously, someone who has the ear of the president. For example, during the old USIA days, and USIA, United States Information Agency, was folded into the State Department in 1999, which may be part of the problem. We don't advocate resuscitation of it. But during those days, Edward R. Murrow, Leonard Marks, people like that, really, who were directors of USIA, had the ear of the president. We want someone else like that. We also call for a special advisory board of experts who would advise the special counselor, and we also call for the resuscitation of a National Security Council Interagency Policy Coordinating Committee, which would also be part. So a very strong architecture within the White House. And the second thing that we call for that you mentioned is sufficient funding. It's kind of a joke, the amount of money that is now devoted to public diplomacy. We say in our report that public diplomacy is absurdly and dangerously underfunded in this time of peril. And if you take all the programs all together throughout the government, it's about 0.3% of the defense budget. And we believe that this public diplomacy is as important, or certainly plays a tremendously important role in our national security. We need to see it that way.
We're talking about public diplomacy in the Muslim world. The number here, 1-800-989-8255. Let's take a call from Ben. And Ben is in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. Yes, I can hear you.
Hi, yes. I was calling in because I spent 6 or 7 weeks this summer in West Bank Palestinian villages. So I got to meet a lot of Palestinian people. And these are families, shopkeepers, taxi drivers, et cetera, and everyone had something to say, certainly, to me as American, about American policy. And I wanted to comment that I was amazed at the generosity that people had towards me as an American, the welcoming that I got, no hostility whatsoever, but people really wanted to inform me of what American policy was doing to them. So, for instance, I stayed in a village called Jayus, which is very near the wall that is being built, the security barrier that's being built in the West Bank. And we were trying to accompany farmers to their land, which they're now cut off from, and this village has lost 75% of the land. And so people know that their village is dying as a direct result of U.S. support for Israeli policy and the continuing annexation and theft of Palestinian land, and they used to have all of the land in Palestine. So I felt very informed by this, and also amazed that Palestinians were willing to be generous to me as an American.
Thanks very much for your call, and I'm going to follow up on that with a question for our guest, Ben. Thanks for calling. I think he's raising a question here, which is how do you extricate American foreign policy from this whole question of public diplomacy and how people feel about the United States in the Arab world? There's a lot of feeling that the policies are anti-Muslim or anti-Palestinian, and part of the anger has to be coming from that.
Yes, there's no doubt about that, and this is an issue with which we had to deal immediately in our report, and we do in the fifth paragraph on the very first page of the report. We say we fully acknowledge that public diplomacy is only part of the picture. Surveys show much of the resentment toward America stems from our policies, and that is absolutely true. We know that it's hard to decide or to put a number on, you know, what percentage is the policy, what percentage is the communication. There is absolutely no doubt in the minds of every member of this group, and this group was. Our group was made up of Muslim Americans, Christians, Jews, people who were born in Egypt and naturalized citizens, people who were born in Iran. It was a wide variety of people, including, for example, George Salem, who is the head of the Arab American Institute, a very well-known advocate for Palestinian rights. So we absolutely understand the depth of feeling, and if any of us didn't, we learned when we were there.
All right, we're going to get into that a little bit more after the break. We're talking about public diplomacy in the Muslim world. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the art of public diplomacy. How do you win the hearts and minds of a skeptical population? If you've traveled overseas, what images of the U.S. have you encountered? You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And my guest is James Glassman. He's a member of the Advisory Group on Public Diplomacy in the Arab and Muslim World. Many critics of the current state of the American image overseas wish we could return to a golden age of public diplomacy, the time of the Cold War, when savvy communication and good marketing won the hearts and minds of the Eastern Bloc. But is that a fair comparison? Walter Hickson joins us now. He is a professor of history at the University of Akron in Akron, Ohio, and the author of the book Parting the Curtain, Propaganda, Culture, and the Cold War, 1945 to 1961. He joins us from his office in Akron. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Good to be here, Lynn.
First of all, you would say that U.S. efforts to sell America to the Soviet Union, would you say that they were successful?
They were successful in part. There are a lot of similarities, perhaps more than differences, between the public diplomacy then and now, however, in that, as Mr. Glassman has indicated, this public diplomacy is very much secondary, poorly funded, not on the minds of foreign policy planners and pundits generally, has traditionally been dismissed as sort of fluffy. And I think that's a big misconception, and this report is very much on the money in that regard and is devastating in its the figures that it cites about the masses of money spent on a very much militarized foreign policy as opposed to a hearts and minds-oriented foreign policy.
Give us a sense of what public diplomacy was like during the Cold War and how it might compare to now.
Well, Mr. Glassman mentioned Radio Free Europe. That would have been aggressive radio propaganda. There were many others, too, Radio Liberation, Vatican Radio. There were several. At the same time, however, gradually public diplomacy began to be negotiated and I think paid great dividends, publications, exchanges, musical concerts, for example, in the late 50s, the Texan pianist Van Cliburn made a huge impact. American jazz, blue jeans, we know about this sort of thing, rock and roll. A major watershed early in the public diplomacy in the Cold War was when an agreement in the late 50s allowed the U.S. to stage an American national exhibition in Moscow. And that became known for the famous Nixon-Khrushchev kitchen debate, but in fact was an extremely popular display of American automobiles, fashions, IBM computers, lots of things that had a great appeal to the Soviet public. But if I can add, the Soviets had a problem insofar as the so-called Iron Curtain really was a barrier to access the West and to freedom. And that was the fundamental problem of the Soviet Empire, that in an information age it couldn't keep this knowledge out. Today it's very different, and I'm not sure these recommendations, as suggested by the caller, I think, are going to overcome the problems because, in fact, you might say the wall is on the other side this time, and that's a reality that all manner of public relations won't overcome in the Arab Islamic world.
Well, explain what you mean by that, the wall is on the other side.
Well, I mean that, as the caller indicated, Israel is occupying land, and diplomacy has been unable to change that reality. It's a source of permanent anger, resentment, and the United States is inextricably linked with Israeli policy. So as long as settlements continue and the Israeli policy is, we wouldn't normally in our culture use this term, but it's really an apartheid policy. And race and racial views are a big part of that policy. And so these are tremendous public relations problems.
Let me turn to James Glassman now, because you've raised what gets to be the most difficult issue to talk about when you're talking about any of this. And Mr. Glassman, how do you deal with that in terms of this effort toward public diplomacy?
Let me just say that, first of all, the Arab-Israeli issue is tremendously important and if you never traveled to places like Syria and Egypt and talked to people, you certainly get an earful on it and you understand. However, we had problems throughout the Muslim world in countries like Indonesia and countries like Turkey, where the Arab-Israeli conflict is really not a major issue for them. So I think it's much broader than that. But I would also say something that is very clearly in our report, which is that we really do share many objectives with people in the Arab and Muslim world. And let me just read part of the report. Unlike powerful nations of the past, the United States does not seek to conquer but to spread universal ideals, liberty, democracy, human rights, equality for women and minorities, prosperity, and the rule of law. Specifically, according to our values and principles, the American vision for the Arab and Muslim world is for it to become a peaceful, prosperous region working toward participatory government with democracy, social justice, human dignity, and individual freedom for all. Now, there's no doubt that, and this is me talking, there's no doubt that there are people in the Arab and Muslim world who will say, oh, well, you believe in that, we believe in that, but you're hypocrites. And that's true. However, we need to do a much better job in spreading those ideals and making people understand those. And I think that the policy differences will then become less important. Bottom line, there is no doubt that improving public communications, public diplomacy, will have an impact. It's not going to turn the whole thing around, but it will have an impact. We are not doing it now.
All right, let me see if we can get one call in while Professor Hickson is still on the line. Diane in Leesburg, Virginia. Hi, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I, along with 16 other Americans, were in Kenya for about a month this summer and was made to find that our State Department restriction on travel to Kenya or advisory against, and also British Airways restriction on their flights for a while, were misinterpreted, at least by the Kenyans I talked to, thinking that the U.S. was trying to drive a wedge further amongst their own population, the Muslims, which are, I think, around 10% in Kenya. So to be in a, this is a Kenya, we've been there many times, and to be in a friendly country, but they had interpreted our State Department as being meddling in their politics and having driven a wedge among their people.
So this is a case where, James Glassman, something that I think you talk about in this report, misinterpretation of U.S. intentions, that's something that you feel public diplomacy can offset?
Yeah, I think there are broad misinterpretations of what we're doing. And part of it is because we are so big, we are so important in the world, whether we like it or not. So that what we found in our travels was that, for example, Egypt. I mean, Egypt is having some economic problems, which they're blaming on the United States. Quite frankly, I know a little bit about this subject, and it's absurd to blame that on the United States. On the other hand, I understand where they're coming from, and it's important for us to be able to communicate context. And that's what we're not doing a very good job of. And by communicating context better, by getting people to understand what the United States is all about and what our policies really are, I think we'll have a little bit less of that kind of friction.
All right, let's take one more call. Guy in Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I just recently returned from Switzerland. I lived and worked over there for a year. And my first comment goes to the fact that all the negativism that I experienced was against President Bush and not the Americans. So in terms of the Western European allies, most of what I encountered was definitely not anti-Americanism, but anti-Bush. I'm not sure how you can overcome that. The second point goes to something that the International Herald Tribune reported on this week, and that is that there's a feeling in Western Europe that this whole movement into Iraq was staged by President Bush, and you can call it conspiracy theories or whatever, but I experienced it for a year among a number of people that I met over there, and as I said, the IHT just reported on it this week. That tells the people in Western Europe, and probably the Muslims too, that Iraq was nothing but an oil war, and also that the media in Europe reports on things that in a different way than we do in the States. They get information that in the American media will not be dwelt upon, and I think that changes their opinion somewhat.
All right.
And could I respond to that?
Yes, Professor Exon, I was just going to ask you too.
Yeah, I think what the caller is reflecting is that, again, the notion that there are certain international realities that have to be dealt with, and the unilateralism in Iraq and the current policy of not turning over the government to the Iraqis, and it's clear the U.S. wants to shape post-war Iraq, and that's going to be seen as hegemonic behavior, and it's hard to manage that problem. But I do want to emphasize that I think this report is very good, and that the more focus on hearts and minds and the less on trying to solve all the problems through militarization, which has dominated our foreign policy, the better. We certainly need more Arabic-speaking people. And as a former 10-month Fulbright scholar to the former Soviet Union myself, I very much know how valuable those kind of exchange programs can be for both sides. And, you know, occasionally congressmen view these as, well, you know, we have a budget problem. We can't spend money on this frilly sort of thing. In fact, I think those kind of exchange programs, cultural programs, real hearts and minds type programs pay enormous benefits.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Professor Hickson.
Thank you.
Walter Hickson is a professor of history at the University of Akron in Akron, Ohio. He's the author of Parting the Curtain, Propaganda, Culture, and the Cold War. He joined us from his office in Akron, Ohio. Many of the programs designed to advance our foreign policy around the world have been around so long their original purpose is often overlooked. This includes everything from Fulbright scholarships to the Peace Corps and some programs you may be less aware of.
Hier spricht die Stimme Amerikas. Heute und täglich von heute an.
This is a voice speaking from America. Daily at this time, we shall speak to you about America and the war. The news may be good or bad. We shall tell you the truth.
For more than 50 years, the government-owned Voice of America has broadcast news around the world, reaching 94 million people through radio, television, and the Internet. But you can't hear it at home because the government is prohibited from broadcasting in the United States. Joining us now is VOA former Deputy Director Alan Heil. He's the author of a recent history of the network called Voice of America. We reached him at his home in Alexandria, Virginia. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be with you, Len.
Now, did VOA begin as what you would call propaganda?
During World War II, of course, it was founded with the idea of combating Axis propaganda in Europe and in Asia. But it evolved quickly, as you can tell from that voice clip that you had, and was committed from the very beginning to leveling with listeners and giving them an accurate and balanced picture of what was going on in their world and even in their own countries on any given day.
And how has it changed over the years?
Well, certainly when you consider that that first broadcast was in German and was a 15-minute broadcast that was relayed by landline to Europe, and then you look at this mighty Voice of America today, a broadcaster in 55 languages to all areas of the world via radio and television and the Internet, you can see that there's been a tremendous evolution in what it does. I think the bedrock principle, the news may be good and the news may be bad and we will tell you the truth, has gained a great deal of strength over all of those years. And I'm fond, really, of thinking of the words of the late news director, Bernie Kamensky, who died last week, who said that the Voice of America should reflect American values in the sense that it reports all aspects of any given story, the good and the bad, in a balanced way, that will then provide that exact context that's been described so often in this program for the listener, the very full picture that it provides in 55 languages to all areas of the world, is in a way the best form of public diplomacy. After all, the Founding Fathers said in the Declaration of Independence, let facts be submitted to a candid world. In a sense, they were the first practitioners of public diplomacy.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us today, Mr. Heil.
Thank you.
Alan Heil is the author of the book Voice of America and a past deputy director of the VOA. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. James Glassman, does the VOA model work for what you this panel has decided, has said needs to be done in terms of the Muslim world, or does it need to go beyond that? Where does that fit into what
you're talking about? Well, I think it works. There are two caveats, and one is that we really need to do a much better job of measuring how well Voice of America, exchange programs, book translation programs, all the many public diplomacy programs work. And that's not being done right now. We call for a culture of measurement. Find out whether they work. If they really do work, increase them. I mean, we are very much in favor of increasing exchanges. The second thing that troubles us about international broadcasting, and not just Voice of America, it's actually more the parts of international broadcasting sponsored by the U.S. government that go to the Arab and Muslim world, is that they are largely outside of the strategic direction, such as it is today. We want to bring them inside that tent. And it's a very important part of our recommendations. We need a direct strategic direction from the top. Where are we going? What are the messages? And I'm not talking about slanting the news. The news operation should be completely separate. But we need to know what the strategic direction is, and it needs to apply to all public diplomacy tools.
Let's see if we can get one quick call in here. We have a call from Weil in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Weil.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. You have a wonderful program.
Thank you.
I wanted to point out that I'm from the Middle East, and I actually live and practice medicine here in Boston. And what we always see is negatives, negatives, negatives in the Middle East. I visit often, and I sit in homes of people, which I hear nothing but negatives. The real thing is that we do concentrate on nothing but negatives and try to explain and defend negatives. Well, I really think that somehow there should be a positive look and a positive view put on the on this whole aspect. If you look at the hundreds of private and government initiatives and projects that have been done in the Middle East and throughout the Muslim world, hardly anybody in the public knows about them. And it is a shame that people don't know about them. I know myself, for example, that a major medical center in the U.S. has had an affiliation with a medical school and a medical center in the in one of the Middle East, and nobody really knows about that stuff that goes on. And
I'm going to ask our guest to very briefly respond.
Yeah, let me respond because this is a very,
thanks for your call.
Weil, this is a very, very important point. We make it in our report. In fact, we have a photograph of the Cairo Opera House, which the Japanese contributed to the Egyptians. We built, the United States contributed essentially the entire infrastructure, the electrical system, the plumbing, the sewage system, and drinking water system, and so forth in Cairo. It is true that unfortunately we have not done a very good job of telling the rest of the world the things we do. You know, on the other hand, Americans aren't very good at that. We're not very good at blowing our own horn, but we talk about it's really important to do a lot more of that and do it better.
Thanks so much for being with us today, James
Glassman.
After the break, we'll be talking about the latest news from North Korea. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Here are a few of the stories NPR News is working on this afternoon. The man in charge of looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, David Kaye, is on Capitol Hill today. He's briefing congressional intelligence committees about his findings. And Arnold Schwarzenegger has made a public apology after allegations of sexual harassment appeared in the Los Angeles Times this morning. We'll have more on that story later this hour. And you can hear more on both these stories coming up on All Things Considered from NPR News. Tomorrow on Science Friday, Ira Flatow's guests talk about the financial conflicts of interest in rainforest conservation.